I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, we love our cars, but do they love us back? It's a question that needs an answer because there's an argument to be made that our addiction to cars is keeping us poor, unhealthy, isolated, and on a road to ruin. The pervasive influence of car culture has created a global system with immense human, economic, and environmental cost. Even the promise of future technologies like EVs and self-driving cars will not solve this. Consider a fundamental reorientation towards people-centric urban planning and robust public transportation networks. At the very least, we should be aware of the hidden cost of the car culture and the trade-offs that are there. Are they worth it, or are we being taken for a ride? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Are you ready to amplify your impact through workplace giving? Many employers match donations, doubling or even tripling your support for TPR's local and global programming. Some employers even match gifts from retirees and spouses, so your contribution can go even further. Check if your company participates today by visiting tpr.org/workplacegiving.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. How much does it cost to own and operate a car or a truck? As of 2024, AAA reports that the average cost to own and operate a new car in the U.S. is about $12,297 per year. Let's call it $1,000 a month. That includes depreciation, loan interest, fuel, insurance, maintenance, repair, tires, registration, taxes, and fees. That's what you can see. We can type that out. That's a cost. But there are also hidden costs. And you really can't put dollars on these things, human lives, air pollution, the impact it has on social equity, isolation that cars cost, and more. So many may argue that these costs are trade-offs for the freedom and prosperity that cars can provide. But when examined, those trade-offs may not seem actually like a good deal. The new book, Roadkill, Unveiling the True Cost of Our Toxic Relationships with Cars, looks and exposes those hidden costs. And we're joined by the co-authors Henrietta L. Moore and Arthur Kay. Welcome both y'all to The Source.
Thank you very much, Dave. We're really pleased to be with you.
Well, you're talking to car country, truck country.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. We've been looking forward to this conversation with communities in Texas for a while now.
Well, the conversation of our listeners, we have a phone number they can call in to join in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can also email us at thesource@tpr.org to jump into this conversation. Well, let's talk about the cost in lives. Many people have been in car accidents, seen car accidents. We know about car accidents. What do we need to know about the cost in lives with car culture, Henrietta?
Well, what we know about it is that since the car was invented, the number of people who've been killed by a car is equivalent to the number of people killed in World War I and World War II. That's an enormously large number of people. And every year, about 184 million people get killed by cars. So this is a huge toll that the car is taking on ordinary human lives.
I use the phrase car accident, but one can make a case that are they really accidents, or are they just something that a problem that we have in the way that we design cars and highways and transportation systems, Arthur?
That's exactly right, David. I mean, a huge sleight of hand, really, of what we call the car industrial complex has been to rebrand a car crash as an accident. But if you can really accurately forecast how many people are going to die from car quote-unquote accidents, then is that really an accident? And we argue in our book, Roadkill, that this is actually designed into the system. I mean, one of the most shocking and frankly upsetting things is that there's one evening, I should say, of the year where we can predictably calculate when we're going to kill the most amount of children throughout the entire day. I wonder, David, do you think you can guess what day of the year that is?
New Year's Day, maybe.
New Year's Day. It's actually, sadly, Halloween. So the couple of hours from when kids break up from school on Halloween across the United Kingdom, the United States, and other areas where the date is for, is, sadly, you see a very predictable, every year, a spike of between 30 and 70%, depending on the country in question, of very predictable deaths and serious injury of kids. And so we're really designed into the system that on the very day of the year where we try and give kids that extra little bit of freedom, that they immediately come in contact with cars and die in large numbers. And one of the great ironies of it, I mean, is that in response to this, adults have come up with a very ingenious idea called trunk and treat, which is, instead of letting your kids roam around the neighborhood, you go to a car park, your cars circle like kind of wagons going out west back in the day, and then kids can go from car trunk to car trunk, collecting their sweets rather than house to house. So this is kind of how kind of endemic and how built into the system kind of the deaths from cars have become.
Henrietta, the idea that we have this transportation system that pretty much everyone is taking part in, and then we have these incredible numbers of people who are killed or maimed every year because of this system. If you were to, like, say, we're starting from scratch, and I'm going to say, listen, I got this idea. We're going to have cars. We're going to have roads. People are going to drive around. This is how we're going to get around everybody. It's going to cost, you know, a couple hundred thousand lives every year, but it'll be worth it. Do you think people would go with that?
No, I don't. I think that's one of the most extraordinary things. Can you imagine any government putting forward that policy, saying, hey, you can have fantastic trade-off. You'll be free as a bird to go to the coast anytime you like. You can go and look at this wonderful landscape in Texas, enjoy the biodiversity. It's just unfortunate that there are going to be all of these people who are going to be part of a collateral damage. And I noticed that in your news that came just before this show, that you were talking about this wildlife bridge. Well, in the United States, a million animals and insects and so on, and birds are killed by cars.
I think a billion.
Yeah, that's right. A million every day. So in a year, it's like 360 million or more. And in fact, the numbers are growing all the time, and they're extraordinarily high. And so you really need that land bridge.
But the idea that, so do we have, Henrietta, a collective amnesia? I mean, you say these are hidden costs. How hidden are they really? Or are we just, they're hidden in plain sight?
I think they are hidden in plain sight, although some of the real costs are not so evident to people. So, for example, the number of people who are affected by air pollution, or the effect of air pollution on increased levels of dementia in the population. These kinds of information, I think, are harder to come by and are probably hidden from people to a very large extent. But I also think it's that we've been sold this idea, as Arthur was suggesting, that the car is freedom, that it's a convenience, and that somehow if that was to be constrained in any way or taken away from us, or we had to slow down the amount of times we use the car, that we would lose some identity, we'd lose some autonomy, we'd lose some way of thinking about ourselves, maybe as Texans or as Americans. And I think that one of the things we have to do there is to try to talk to each other about whether that's really true.
Well, I mean, how free is it if you're basically, you have to have a car? You don't have the freedom to choose whether or not to have a car, at least, you know, here in our neck of the woods, you got to have a car if you're going to, you know, get around. There is a public transportation system, but I would, you know, it needs help.
And that's a huge part of it, is that what we term in the book, we call it the car industrial complex. And they've really sold all of us, I mean, myself and Henrietta included, on this idea that car equals freedom, because we're offered a range of choices of the kind of car we can buy. We can customize it to the nth degree, you know, literally millions of different customizations you can make within your car in terms of both model, financing plan, paint color, stereo system, etc. But actually, we've really only got one choice, which, as you exactly say, David, is to drive. And so they're very happy that you can make any choice you like, you know, as long as you keep driving and keep stuck behind the wheel. So
like Henry Ford said, you can have any color model T you want as long as it's black.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right, so we're going to take a break here. I'm going to get a caller on the air. Yamani has called in. You'll get you on when we come back. If you want to join the conversation, talk about you're just rethinking our urban areas. Can we do a better job? People focus, people mobility, mass transit. How do we get there? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company. They are committed to helping policyholders build strong and thriving businesses through their exceptional service. More at texasmutual.com/texansdeliver. Texas Mutual.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Imagine a world where you don't have to have a car. You could choose not to have a car and you'd be able to use public transportation. You'd be able to walk around and do everything that you need to do. And then think about, you know, hey, that's about $12,000 a year that you don't have to put into owning a car. That money can be put into, investments and capital building ways instead of maintaining what we call is the car industrial complex. There's a new book out. It comes out tomorrow. Roadkill, Unveiling the True Cost of Our Toxic Relationship with Cars. And we're speaking with the two co-authors, Henrietta Moore and Arthur Kay. You can join the conversation, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And let's go to Yamini. Yamini, am I saying that okay?
It's Yamini.
Yamini, okay. All right, well, I'm sorry about that. It's a beautiful name, but you're on the air. Go ahead.
Great. Hello, my name is Yamini. I just wanted to call in and say I agree with what our guest speakers are saying, and I also wanted to let listeners know that we have a local group of advocates here in San Antonio that are asking for change and are asking to make our streets safer. Our group is called Strong Towns San Antonio, and we advocate for safer streets, making our city more walkable, and also making our cities and communities more financially resilient. So if that's something you are interested in, we would love for you to check us out and attend one of our events.
How do they check you out? Where do they find you?
So we have a Facebook group called Strong Towns San Antonio, as well as a meetup group called Strong Towns San Antonio. You can also find us on Instagram, Strong Towns SAPX. And we also have a website. So take your pick.
All right. Well, thanks for calling and sharing that. I appreciate that. Arthur Kay, 15-minute cities. What is that?
The 15-minute city is an idea invented by a guy called Carlos Moreno. And what it really is saying that the things that are important to you, whatever that happens to be, whether that's dropping kids at school, whether it's a really good place to work, whether that is somewhere to fix your bike, whether it's somewhere to get a delicious hamburger, all of those things can be, not have to be, but can be, you have a good option within a 15-minute walk, cycle, or public transit. So it's really a kind of people-centric, a person-first way of thinking about your life, your neighborhood, and the way of getting around your city. So, and the really exciting thing about it, I think, is that it's whatever's important to you. So your 15-minute city, David, will be different from mine because you will have different priorities in your life compared to mine. Similarly, Henrietta's will be different again. And it's that diversity of choice, that freedom to build the 15-minute city that you want and the neighborhood that you want, which is kind of a really exciting piece of it. Where it's kind of, let's say, been misrepresented or gone wrong, I mean, we know Carlos Moreno well, the creator of it, and we talked to him for this book. But where it's been miscreated and gone wrong has been basically during COVID and some information put out by the World Economic Forum. It got caught up in some conspiracy theories around this and kind of got seen as a way for governments and big tech to try and control us and to kind of keep us stuck in 15-minute neighborhoods without being able to actually get out of these places. Kind of think Hunger Games, being stuck in your kind of specific quadrant, that is a misrepresentation, not what it is, but that's kind of, I guess, how maybe some of the listeners in the popular zeitgeist, how it's been captured.
Are there any good examples of 15-minute cities or taking a city like we have, which is basically built for cars, into saying, okay, we're going to create something that will work like a 15-minute city, and how was that accepted?
Yeah, so, I mean, I'll give you two examples of cities that are currently, for this very specific niche, a 15-minute city, and they're they may seem quite silly examples, but they are the kind of, for those populations, are important. So I live in London. A friend of mine lives in Paris. In Paris, roughly 94% of the population are within a 5-minute walk of a place where they can serve fresh croissants and bread. So a bakery is within a 5-minute walk of 94% of Parisians. So this is kind of an extreme example, because Parisians really value delicious croissants. Where I live in London, almost, I think it's sound like 92% of everyone in the UK is within a 15-minute walk or cycle of a Boots pharmacy, somewhere they can buy medicine or hairspray or a sandwich or something like this. So these are examples of 15-minute cities that exist now. The really idea about how you make cities that are not currently 15-minute cities and try and, or 15-minute neighborhoods, I should say, and try and nudge them in that direction is thinking about what are the bits of commerce. So that might be saying, is there a way to introduce a corner shop into your neighborhood? What are the journeys that you find you have to jump in a car for? You know, it's not reasonable to expect there to be a top university and a world-class theatre within your 15-minute city, because that is something which one would typically travel slightly longer distances for. But it's thinking about, are there a good local restaurant, a good local bar, a good little shop nearby, a good whatever that thing is that is makes your life better. Think about how that can be integrated into it. So it's it does need engagement from kind of the broader community and also sometimes from government. But it's also thinking of it as commerce. So how a small business can actually be an important piece in terms of social value and urban design.
Let's go to a caller, Mike. And Mike, you're on the air.
In regards to public transportation and getting around, and I use the VIA public transportation system in San Antonio to get back and forth to work. And while it is not perfect, it has provided me the way to go to work for, 90% of my work commute for the last nearly 5 years. But another interesting comment was something I had read from a gentleman in Linz, Austria, about 20 years ago, that he considered it a measure of the wealth of his country that he did not have to own an automobile, that the public transportation needs that his taxes supported totally took care of, his needs to get around the city. And you think about that, you live in a place where you don't have to own a car. You don't have to buy gas. You don't have to pay car insurance. You don't have to buy tires. You don't have to repair the car. And I think that's a very eye-opening observation of, that, said, a measure of the wealth of the country that he does not have to own an automobile.
Mike, thank you for that. Henrietta Moore, the fact that we are basically held hostage to this car culture, is that an accident? Why do we have to have a car?
No, I don't think that you necessarily need to own a car. There are maybe times when you need to use a car, and this is something we talk about in the book. So, for example, if you're going to put all of your family in the car and head to the coast then and carry a lot of luggage with you and the dog and maybe the cat and maybe the budgerigar as well, then you're going to need a car probably, or find it more convenient to do so. But exactly as Mike has just said in that last call, you don't actually need to have a car in to do the day-to-day things. And there are lots of ways, and that's what Yemini was also saying, communities can get together to make a real change in how you do this. So in fact, Texas itself has already done that in lots and lots of places, including San Antonio and other cities. So the idea that you can bike and roll to school, for example, so with a very easy intervention of putting a small bike and a skateboard lane alongside the main arterial road, you can get all your kids going to school. They don't necessarily need to go in a vehicle of any kind, and certainly not in a car. And that already cuts down the number of journeys that are being made. And that already improves air quality and it reduces the chances of accident. especially during that crucial moment of getting to school. So there are lots and lots of small things that you can do. And even within the city where you imagine, oh, we must have a car because we need to have trucks and cars delivering things. So it's true that the way we live now, buying things online, that, for example, in New York, one in five New Yorkers gets more than four packages a week. So there's been an awful lot of increase of traffic on the streets in New York just to hand out those parcels from all the people who send them as online deliveries. But on the other hand, New York has also brought in these fantastic new cargo bicycles, which means that they operate out of hubs on the Upper West Side, and their big vehicles drop off there, and the cargo bikes pick that stuff up, sometimes with handcarts, sometimes with cargo bikes, and then deliver those throughout the city. And that's already cutting down pollution and making things easier for people and quicker.
Well, Henrietta, what about these, you know, ride-sharing operations like Uber and Lyft? Is that an alternative, or are you just still part of the system?
Well, I think there are two things to be said about them. So, yes, it's true that having ride-sharing systems, for example, in Texas, you have various kinds of van pooling. Here in the UK and in France, for example, we have various types of car sharing for longer distance journeys. But it's a problem because what we have now, particularly in London, for example, is that with Uber drivers, most of them are empty most of the time. They're circling, looking for work. So the amount of idling time that's actually involved in the process is just because you want a just-in-time system means that they're there, but they're running their engines and they're driving around and around and around. So actually, you're getting more cars on the street through those demand systems and not necessarily easier movement for people, because people need more choice. They need to be able to choose whether they're going to go by car, whether they're going to walk, whether they're going to take a transit system.
And they're creating more congestion because they're just out there driving around.
Exactly. They're just creating a lot of congestion. And then there comes the issue of how well they're paid and, you know, what their terms of employment are. And there are all kinds of questions there as well, which are ones that we have to think about. So it's not just that the car is there, but what kinds of working environments is the car industrial complex actually creating for people to participate in?
So then what would be just first steps? Is this acknowledging that these costs are there, these hidden costs, and that there are hidden alternatives as well, Arthur?
Yeah, so in the book, we outline a few different approaches to it. So the first thing is really thinking about kind of informing ourselves and asking this question about what can we know, and thinking about it in terms of making sure that we actually know the true cost of the car rather than just everyone focuses understandably on the ticket price. Because we argue that we've become car blind. And it's one of those things that now when you walk through a street or walk through a neighborhood, it's one of the things that you can't unsee when you see it. You just kind of see cars everywhere and car infrastructure everywhere. But that's kind of a small part of the book. But what we're really advocating for, and Henrietta can talk more about this, is thinking in a much deeper way about how we can live better together and what a really good life in a city looks like. We quote and kind of talk about in the book the work, unusually perhaps for a book about cars, but we talk to somebody called Ramit Sethi, who's a personal finance guru. And it's one of those rare occasions where a personal finance guru actually agrees with economists, because usually they're talking about very, very different things. And what he describes as your rich life. So what are the things that are important to you? And instead of being tied into or obliged to spend a vast amount of your income, and as we show in the book, you know, over the course of a lifetime, it could easily be $500,000 to $1 million worth of expenditure on maintaining a car. Instead, making a proactive decision to say, actually, I'm going to take that same $500,000 or $1 million, and I'm going to spend it on the things that are really, really, really important to me. That might be the choice to whether or not to be able to afford to send your child to college. That might be the choice about whether or not to, you know, buy a second home as a beach home or a holiday home. That may be the choice about whether or not to be able to look after your parents when they get ill. So these are really fundamental choices and significant amounts of money that we're talking about. I don't know if Henrietta, you want to pick that up, especially around that kind of point around living better together. I know it's a lot of the work you do at UCL.
Well, yes. I mean, one of the issues here is that very often when governments or local governments try to do something about cars, so they try to bring in low traffic neighborhoods or they try to restrict the speed at which you can drive through a neighborhood, there are protests. People often feel very, very strongly that something is being taken away from them. But I think what we say in the book is we give lots of examples of communities all around the world who are already taking a different view themselves. They're taking the first step and saying, actually, we want to be able to cross the road safely.
Yeah.
We don't want to have all these toxic fumes next to our house. And there's a very good example, which I like, from Ljubljana, which is the capital of Slovenia, where they brought in restrictions on car movements in the center of town.
So I got to take a break here. We'll pick up the conversation in 2 minutes. We're talking about the book Roadkill, Unveiling the True Cost of Our Toxic Relationship with Cars on The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The car industry has skillfully marketed itself as a symbol of progress and freedom, but critics of the car industrial complex make the case that a car-centered society perpetuates dependence through intertwined economic, political, and cultural forces. Are we being taken a ride by the toxic relationship with cars? The book is Roadkill, Unveiling the True Cost of Our Toxic Relationship with Cars, and the co-authors are with us, Henrietta Moore and Arthur Kay. Henrietta, we cut you off, and you were talking about how public policy is probably not going to get us out of this. It's going to be people power that really does it. Is that true?
Yeah, I think it is true. And I think it's about people getting together in communities and thinking about how they want to live a better quality of life. Because quality of life in cities, I mean, it's not always great everywhere. So if you're thinking about Austin or San Antonio, these are cities with a lot of green spaces and a lot of eco-friendly activity, a lot of community work, a lot of way of thinking about green innovation. So you're in a good space if you're living in one of those cities. But if you're living in other cities, then basically you're having to cross, you know, 4 or 5 lane highways. You're find that you have to travel enormous distances to get ordinary things that you need for day-to-day living. The costs of transport going to work are terribly, terribly high. And when you take the cost of housing and transport together, you find that many families are really, really struggling to make a good life for themselves and for their children. And so one of the things we have to think about is how much is the car involved in making our lives actually more precarious and not providing us, as we think, with freedom and convenience.
I did a story earlier this year about in Texas, we have these giant, massive highway flyover intersections. They can be 5, 6, 7 stories tall. And I wanted to compare them to like the pyramids and great cathedrals of societies. They were more, you know, they had that practical function of getting all these people crossing over and going these where these highways intersect. But Henrietta, looking at them as to me as this is more than that. This is a symbol of how we worship vehicles because we built this giant thing that actually gives you like a visceral response when you drive over them. And I'd be interested in your reaction to that.
Yeah, and I think they were quite wonderful things, weren't they? These were great monuments to the modernity of the 20th century. And I think what we're saying in the book is, okay, we understand that, but what are going to be the monuments of the 21st century? Surely those are going to be things like access to green spaces, improved biodiversity, regenerating the planet, resetting ourselves on a better course. We're not necessarily going to be wanting all of that concrete to stand in for the things we need to achieve in the 21st century. And we're all aware of that, but we're not always sure how to take things forward. And that's where people power comes in. That's where the question of how communities are prepared to discuss these things with each other and try to resolve some of their apparent unhappiness about certain kinds of trade-offs is really important.
Well, Arthur Kay, we have already the built environment, all the investments, the concrete's been poured. These things exist. How do you work with the environment we have now to get to a world where you don't need a car?
that's the million-dollar question, David, about how we can we talk about it in terms of retrofit suburbia or knit together some of these broken communities. And one of the things we did in the book Roadkill was, instead of kind of looking at the kind of the generic solutions, looking at cities that are already working with this, like Amsterdam or Helsinki or, you know, places in you know, rich Nordic countries, one of the best examples of this is actually in your very state of Texas. And if you haven't done a story on it yet, David, I hope you will, because in Dallas, they're building something called the Southern Gateway Park, which is an absolutely incredible piece. You were talking to Henrietta just then about the huge highways, and what they've done there is actually over Interstate 35. And I hope somebody from Dallas will dial in and tell us all about it, what it's like on the ground. But over Interstate 35, the local community has been working for a long, long time and eventually convinced the government to build what's called a cap park. So this is building a public space, a park, over the top of Interstate 35, connecting two communities. I mean, the communities were actually cut in half in the 1960s when Interstate 35 was built right through the middle. And so the Oak Cliff neighborhood, after, you know, whatever that is, you know, nearly 70 years, is being reunited at last through this incredible project, the Southern Cap Park. And it's paid for partly by the new real estate that is created through it, also by the uplift in values around it. And also at the same time, it's creating an incredible public space for those local communities to enjoy. So it's those kind of things. Again, you know, you can do it in Texas. You know, Texas is one of the most car-centric places on the planet. And there are amazing projects that are happening in Dallas and all over Texas that I'm sure you're all over, David. But if you haven't yet, you should go out and do a story with the team at the Southern Gateway Park.
Well, it sounds like the land bridge type of a thing that we have here. And they're proposing one for San Antonio as well, another one near as part of the Project Marvel situation. But I want to ask you about, so it looks like, though, we are at an inflection point with the way that we interact with our transportation with cars because of EVs and self-driving cars. This is all happening right now in real time, very quickly. But Henrietta Moore, you say that EVs, electric vehicles, are not a solution. How is that?
Well, they're a partial solution, because they're not using fossil fuels, but they are also still producing pollution in the cities, because pollution isn't just what comes out of the tailpipe. It's also what's created by the dust and the brake wear and all the other things that come off mostly the tires, really, of moving around. But also the other problem about electric vehicles is that as we begin to think that they are the solution without looking into it really carefully, we're all moving towards them. So actually it's not doing anything to reduce the overall number of cars in the city and the number of journeys we make by car. So what we say in the book is, yes, they're a good thing, but you have to bear in mind that what we're trying to do is to say to people, look, you can have much more choice. You don't have to have your city authorities, your local authorities, spending all this money on producing new roads and masses of car infrastructure. They could use all that money to make the city more livable, to make it a better place to live. They could use it to invest in health and the education of your children. There's a huge amount of money has gone into supporting the whole car system, and actually diverting those funds to do something else with them would make your life a lot pleasanter.
I mean, don't you have a number, what, $20 trillion or something that's necessary in order to upgrade the grid system in order to support EVs? And if that money was used to put in just into public transportation, we wouldn't have to do that.
Yeah, so I mean, the figures in terms of what a transition looks like to a EV-based thing are shocking to, I mean, such an extreme extent that the numbers get pretty ludicrous pretty fast. And I'd add to that as well, David, to building on what Henrietta was saying there, we should also be slightly careful what we wish for, because as Henrietta says, what we're really arguing in the book is less car, gross tonnage of car in the world. So that might be moving a three-car household to a two-car household. It might be every other trip thinking, could I, you know, walk to the shop rather than hop in the car and get there in 5 minutes? Could I take a nice walk and get there in 20 minutes? But one of the places where is the most advanced in terms of electric vehicle adoption is in Norway. 94% of new cars last quarter in Norway were electric cars. So they have really, really gone for adoption of electric cars. However, you would think that therefore that would be a kind of a net good thing. And the government has subsidized this to the tune of tens of billions of dollars. But in fact, there's been a study that came out literally a couple of weeks ago, which showed that with the adoption of electric cars, that people who own them actually drive 10 to 20% more than their internal combustion engine alternatives. There are a whole bunch of psychological reasons around that, David, that we probably don't have time to go into here. But it's one of those things, again, to be careful what we wish for in terms of it's not necessarily as good as we think the flip to electric. And it's certainly not the silver bullet in terms of solving some of the issues that we talk about in the book in terms of the economics, the personal finance, the deaths, the other challenges, the kind of the neighborhoods, the loneliness, et cetera, that all kind of stem from this car-centric and car-dependent system.
So when people see something as possibly being less cost, then they use it more. So is that what's happening in Norway, you think, Arthur?
Well, there's a lot of different factors to it. One is definitely kind of the lower day-to-day. There's a higher sticker price up front, but there's often a lower running cost. The second is that it's subsidized by the government, so that makes it still less expensive. And then there's a big piece as well that is thinking around, because people think it's kind of good, you know, some kind of moral good in terms of they're not burning fossil fuels, they're using electric power, but therefore it's kind of fine to, you know, it's kind of the same as walking or cycling, and therefore I might as well get in the electric car and it's not that different. And there's, again, we claim this is a narrative, a mis-selling through the car industrial complex, and actually throughout Europe and the EU, and indeed the United States, there's actually now a big crackdown in terms of the advertising ombudsmen, so the regulators of advertising, to make sure that electric car companies don't overstate the claims about how clean and green they are, which they have been doing and been fined several times for doing.
All right, we got to take a break here. When we come back, I want to ask you about self-driving vehicles and what the promise of that means or the peril of that might mean, and also what kind of urban planning and infrastructure do you think would be the most effective to de-emphasize cars in favor of more sustainable mobility. And you can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Do you really need that car? Could you just park it or sell it or do something else with it and just get around on your own two feet or bike or public transportation? What would that be like? How would that change your life? Would you we have an isolation crisis. We all stuck in our cars driving around and being able to meet more people, see new faces. How would that change your life? Would that make you happier? We're talking about Roadkill, Unveiling the True Cost of Our Toxic Relationship with Cars, with the co-authors Henrietta Moore and Arthur Kay. To that point, Henrietta, this isolation crisis that we have, we all driving around in these capsules, these air-conditioned capsules, instead of sharing the road, sharing the path, the journey with other people. Does that make a difference in people's lives?
Yeah, it does. And there's quite a lot of good evidence now that actually, although having a car and the freedom to move around in it is associated in some circumstances with well-being, but longer term, because you spend so much time nose to tail in a traffic jam and there's so much stress around commuting, that it actually has a negative impact on people's mental health. And also, I think that as you're in the car, it does have a strange distancing effect on all of us. It makes us imagine that we're seeing the world through the windscreen, like looking at the world through a bubble. And that inevitably leads to things like road rage, people chasing cyclists and arguing with them, all the things that we experience on the road these days, and which we all actively dislike. There is no one who likes that kind of experience as they're moving around. And so getting out and about and being able to choose how you move around the city and being able to do it in a way that's convenient for you and where you can enjoy being with your family is really important. And so one of the good examples of that is Barcelona, for example, where one of the young mothers there said, well, you know, we used to have this thing of going to school in the car every morning. I would be really in a rush. I had to get these two children into the car. Then we were in a traffic jam. It was extremely stressful. We were nearly always late. And then, of course, the city started implementing a different way of allowing people to move around. And she's now in a situation where her older son, who's 9, can walk to school, and her younger child goes with her and has a little game and play in the playground on the way, and they have a chat. And the whole thing is a great deal less stressful and better for the family and better for family interaction and better for community interaction.
Let's go to caller, David. David, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, yes, Ben. I had a question. Is I have a couple, if you don't mind. You're from the UK, which, I mean, that's awesome and great. And your country is very small compared to my state and, you know, to America. And it may work for your, you know, country, your place, your region. But here in Texas, if you live out in rural Texas, it's very hard to get to places that you're going to work at. Like, I work as a handyman, and I also work on a small ranch, and I need my truck to pick up hay, to pick up feed, to pick up other things. And I also like having my freedom and not living in a social society that dictates me to say, no, you're going to drive this. So that's just my two cents, man.
Well, David, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Good points there. So, Henrietta, do you want to reply to David?
Yeah. So, David, these are really good points. So it's not that we're saying to you, you don't drive a car, or you shouldn't drive a car. There are lots of examples, even in the UK. And by the way, the UK would fit 3 times into Texas. So you're right. Texas is an awful lot bigger than the UK. But the issue here is you need your car to get to work. Unless there's something that is done in terms of, you know, car sharing or providing you with other infrastructure, you're going to carry on needing that car. And that's fine. But what about all the people who are sitting in cars when they don't need to be in cars, right? When they could be doing something else? There could be a bit of balance here. And I think it's about the balance that we're talking about. So when you get into the city, how do you feel? You often find yourself, I'm sure, in a traffic jam. I mean, I live in London, and one of the things that I love about London now is, guess what? I'm in town without my car. So I don't have to park it. I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to pay for it. I don't even have to give it a moment's thought. And like you, I'm a driver, and I love driving. But I'm very, very pleased not to have it in the town. So it's about choice. It's about people having the right kind of choice for the circumstance they're in. So you will need the car. And people who live in rural UK also, it's a tiny place compared to Texas, but they also need their car. They can't get in without it. But equally, in the UK, which, as you say, is smaller, we've already done things that make life harder for people in rural areas, because we've already decided, for example, to get rid of rural buses, particularly rural school buses, because we decided we didn't want to pay for them. We wanted to put money into other things, mostly roads. So I think there are choices to be made. And what would be really great would be to know how you getting together with other people in your community could think about having much more choice in your mobility options.
Arthur Kay, what kinds of urban planning and infrastructure have you found to be the most effective to de-emphasize cars in favor of more sustainable mobility?
Yeah, so As you note there, David, and Henry touched on, you know, David's choice to drive is exactly the right one. I mean, we're focused really on the 1 billion people who live in cities and drive cars around cities.
And their cars sit there 95% of the time doing nothing.
Exactly. So they're idle most of the time. They're very, very, very expensive, and they're a nightmare spatially and all the rest of it. So, you know, for people who live in the countryside or in very difficult, knitted together places, we're definitely not having a go at them at all. It's also worth remembering that, you know, America was the great land of the train. You know, the great fortunes of the late 19th and early 20th century were, you know, from rail. And again, in the UK, at the same time that we shut down a lot of our rural train stations and train networks, was exactly the same time that we built our motorways, the same as your interstate highway system. So I think there's also, as I know, touched on this kind of points around buses and trains that were operating effectively and moving a lot of those costs and those subsidies from public transit to private transit. To your point, David, around kind of like some of the solutions, we see is really, you know, it's back to this 15-minute city point, is around what do you want to see in your neighbourhood. The example I often come back to is my grandmother. She lives in Dublin, in Ireland. And when she walks out of her front door, she doesn't have a pavement. She walks out of her door and then she's immediately on a relatively busy road. She's 92. Hmm. And there's no real options for her. There's no bus service in her neighbourhood. There's basically no options for her to get around. Her mobility, her freedom is completely constrained by either having a car and having to have one, you know, to your point, David, of being car dependent and locked in, or not able to get around at all. And so to the, I always say, let's start with the really simple stuff, like, do you have a sidewalk? When you walk out of your home, is there even an option to safely walk you and your child, or you and your grandmother, or you listening to music on your AirPods? Can you walk around your neighbourhood at all? And it's really starting at that basic, starting at that human level, starting at what happens when you put that foot outside your front door. Obviously, we can get into much more technical and nerdy things if we have time, David, but I'd start simple.
So the self-driving cars, we're talking about robo-taxis, they're coming. We have some here in San Antonio preparing to launch. So the idea, though, that the car is basically a computer, and I don't know about you, but I've had my computer hacked. I worry about, like, if I'm dependent upon being in this capsule that's driving me around, if it's hack-proof, Henrietta.
Yeah, well, the point is that unfortunately, these cars are not hack-proof. In fact, they are extremely hackable. And if you go on the internet, as we talk about in the book, you can find instructions on precisely how you're going to hack them. So if you think of the damage that was done in New Orleans or the damage that was done in the city of Liverpool in the UK, both in the last 12 months with somebody driving into crowds of people who were celebrating and enjoying themselves, you wouldn't even need to have that individual in the car to have an accident or so-called like that, an incident like that. And so there are real problems here about safety. There are also real questions about what would happen when the number of these cars actually increases significantly. So just imagine what that the city would be like. And people very often say that one of the difficulties with driving is that it's when people are inattentive, in that moment of sort of relaxation, which we've all been in when we've been behind the wheel, that things get really difficult. And if you can imagine that a lot of stuff is stopped by humans suddenly coming to and thinking, oh, no, this is going wrong, right? I have to take some action. But if there's no possibility of that and anything goes wrong, then it's quite a serious problem.
So trying to, go ahead, Arthur.
I was just going to add to that saying, you know, in the great state of Texas, you are now the proud hosts of, you know, the one of the biggest factories in the world, the Tesla Gigafactory, and now Tesla's headquarters as well. So, you know, this is, you know, live in Austin and coming to San Antonio soon in terms of the Elon Musk's vision of robo-taxis. And he's been very specific and explicit about this being, in his words, a $5 to $7 trillion market cap opportunity for Tesla. So this is, you know, the thing that, you know, if he's going to get his, what is his new latest pay package, a $1 trillion pay package, if he's going to get to the, if he gets to 8 trillion, I believe that he'll get that 1 trillion. And so, you know, robo taxis are not just an afterthought. You've got the world's richest man in your backyard going for it. So it's going to be a very, very interesting and very complex time in terms of some of the citizens of Texas, the citizens of San Antonio and Austin, in terms of what that looks like. And so, you know, you're exactly right, David, in terms of some of the risks around it. And there's literally a drop-down menu on a preloaded hacker forum called parrot.io, where you can literally have your preset settings in order to be able to hack into it and undertake a what's known as a cyberkinetic attack on them. And so the risks and what are known as attack vectors
right
can become very, very large, very fast.
Arthur Kay, Henrietta Moore, they're the co-authors of the new book, Roadkill, Unveiling the True Cost of Our Toxic Relationship with Cars. People should know what the true cost is. I want to thank you so much for coming on board today and talking to us. We appreciate that. And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.